Thank you. Well, I said in that last lecture, I don't think those poor profs got a chance when you get there. There was a time when I couldn't even spell professor. No, I are one. But, yeah, it's good advice. I've been there. It's good advice you got. Well, the other thing, I guess I would say some professors are really pretty good. And, I know during the years that I was at Washington University School of Medicine, I really admired my colleagues, and I think by and large it treated the students well. So, but nonetheless, the advice you got is key. Don't forget it. Inherently Wind. You can see I like cute titles. Isn't that a cute title? Inherently Wind, A Hollywood History of the Scopes Trial. How many are familiar with the Scopes Trial in a general way? Okay, not everybody. It's something I think worth being familiar about. It's it'll be a little history lesson for you, a bit of history. And history is good. They tell us one of the reasons to study history is we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. But looking at it on a more positive view, sometimes we can benefit from the things that were done right in the past as well as the mistakes in the past. And I believe a lot of things were done right and some things were done wrong. In a very famous trial, some people have said that this is the most famous trial in American jurisprudence. I don't know, maybe people nowadays would disagree with some of the more scandalous type of trials that have been aired. But this was nonetheless a historically important one, and interestingly, it took place not terribly far from here, in Dayton, Tennessee. Somewhere between Chattanooga and Knoxville, along the river there. I've been there a couple of times, lovely little town. And that was the site of the famous Scopes Trial of 1925. Took place on between July 10th and the 21st. That's your first shocker right there. That's 11 days. Do you know of any trial of absolutely worldwide importance that takes place in 11 days today? 4 days for the selection of the jury, 7 days for the whole trial, and it dealt with a profoundly important issue that relates directly to the last presentation you heard, and that is, what authority should parents have over what is taught their children, in this case, not in the colleges, but in the primary and secondary schools? Should they have any input at all? And this was battled out in the courts. It ultimately became a sort of a creation-evolution controversy in the courts between two very famous lawyers. And it all hinged around a particular high school teacher by the name of John Scopes, and thus it came to be known as the Scopes Trial. Well, let's dig in. The Wind part comes from first a play, which has been produced by schools all over the country, high schools, colleges, a very popular play. And it also is a movie. In fact, it was several Hollywood movies. Probably the most famous would be this one in the middle here. It came out in 1960. It was a more recent one in 1999. In fact, there have been many made for television versions of it, and they all bear the same name, Inherent the Wind, a misapplication of a verse from Scripture, which is so often the case in Hollywood history. But initially it was a play back in 1955. Let's look at this background here. First of all, with regard to the movie that I will be giving you brief clips from, Inherent the Wind, written by Stanley Kramer, directed by Stanley Kramer in 1960, and it featured some old-timers that you may or may not be familiar with, depending on whether you know the old-time actors or not. Harry Morgan, I can remember him. He was on Dragnet back when television first came out. Oh, yeah, I'm old enough to predate television. I think I predated the wheel, but certainly television. In fact, the first television had a round screen, and I can still remember looking at that round screen on a Zenith at my grandfather's house, and Harry Morgan was one of the investigators in Dragnet. He's the judge, represents the judge in the case here. Frederick March, another well-known actor of yesteryear, represents the legal prosecution of the teacher, John Scopes, who has been convicted of teaching evolution in the schools. And Frederick March, as you'll see, is representing a famous politician lawyer by the name of William Jennings Bryan. And then there's Spencer Tracy. I'm sure you're all familiar with him, if any of the three. And he's representing a very famous, I might even say infamous, lawyer by the name of Clarence Darrow, sort of the archetypical atheist slash agnostic, generally anti-Christian sort of fellow. Let's take a look at this little feature. I was asked to put a red rim around any picture that was not a historical picture because it gets kind of confusing. Sometimes characterizations of history and real historical photographs can be confused. So when we're looking at the movie, you have to bear in mind that there's some fiction going on here, and this fiction has changed the story of the Scopes trial in a very interesting way, to always portray Christians in the absolutely worst possible light and to play up as some sort of hero anyone who's in any way critical of Christianity. You're probably familiar with that principle in Hollywood history and in movies. We don't come out looking too well, by and large, do we, as Christians? Well, that was really the case here, even back in 1960, and in the play in general. The principal characters of the play all have their names changed. Now, this is interesting. Remember the movie Patton? What did they call Patton in the movie Patton? They called him Patton. What did they call Glenn Miller in the Glenn Miller story, or Gandhi in the Gandhi story? But here, we have a play in the movie where all of the characters get their names changed. Everybody knows what the play is about. It's about the Scopes trial in 1925. And it goes through the whole events of that trial. But the names of all of the characters are changed. They keep the same number of syllables. For example, William Jennings Bryan was a lawyer for the prosecution. He's represented by Matthew Harrison Brady. See the similarity. Clarence Darrow, the lawyer for the defense of John Scopes, Henry Drummond, which I could expand on that a little more, too, because that's an interesting selection of names there, but I'll not do that. John Scopes, the teacher. Burke Cates. Notice the syllables, the general. We won't be talking too much about H.L. Mencken until we get to the end. He was kind of your ultimate liberal newspaper reporter who really despised Christianity, openly called them buffoons. And his name in the movie is E.K. Hornbeck. So clearly, they want you to think of the right person, all right, but they give him a different name. Now, why would you do that? Why would you change, say, the name of Patton to Catton in the movie? You'd do that if you were going to so change the facts and so smear the people involved that you would be held up as being very historically inaccurate if you used the original names. So by changing the names, they were free to portray all the characters and the events of the trial any way they wanted to go. And if you complained about it, they said, lighten up, man, it's theater. You don't get angry because an actor is behaving badly. If they're portraying the part of a bad person, that's what they're supposed to act. So this was a very clever thing. It's sort of a docudrama, but they're freed from all historical accuracy or adhering to it by reason of having changed the names. I'll play you little clips from the movie. You might want to pick this up sometime. You can get it through the various movie rental things or online videos, and I think it's worth a watch. Here is the school in Dayton, Tennessee, and inside is poor teacher John Scopes, who will have a different name, but it's John Scopes, and he's valiantly teaching evolution, and some thoroughly nasty people, i.e. the local clergy, and a lawyer approached the school where, I can tell you right now, poor Scopes is in a heap of trouble. So let's take a look at it. Notice they're singing old-time religion precisely out of tune. hear the drums pound. This guy's in a whole heap of trouble here. Basically, when you watch the movie or play Inherit the Wind, if you follow the following principle, you'll be pretty much on target most of the time. If everything you see and everything you hear you assume is precisely opposite the truth, you'll be right most of the time. Let's start right here. They're coming into the classroom to get poor John Scopes. He isn't going to know what hit him until they get there. You'll see that in a subsequent clip. What are the facts of the whole case here? Well, John Sprague de Camp wrote a book called The Great Monkey Trial. Unfortunately, it's out of print. It deals with the Scripps trial. There are many such books out there. And in the book, de Camp is definitely not a creationist. He's definitely not on the side of the Christians. But he does get his facts straight. And most of the books try to do that. He said, and I quote, "The trial wasn't a witch hunt," which is the way the whole thing is set up. Go in and grab the teacher, drag him out by his ear, throw him in jail, persecute him, all for daring to teach evolution. "The trial wasn't a witch hunt, as it has been called, because the accused and his defenders, the witches, were actually the hunters stalking the law with an intent of overturning it or at least making it unenforceable." There's your first interesting fact you need to bear in mind about the Scopes trial. It was a test case. It was a test case that sought to overturn a law in a state that in this case forbid the teaching that man evolved from a lower animal. It didn't forbid any other kind of evolution. Just don't mess with man, okay, or humans. And so there was an effort on the part of some group to make it unenforceable. Now, you're going to see the people of Dayton, Tennessee, being the really miserable people who are out trying to persecute this teacher. It had nothing to do with them in the first place. They weren't the ones that were complaining. The people that complained and tried to make this law in Dayton unenforceable, I'm not at liberty to give you their name, but I'll give you their initials. Does that help? Yeah, the ACLU. Oh, heavens, I might as well tell you. The American Civil Liberties Union out of New York City was very upset by bills that had been passed in about 20 different states, and they all were written the same way. The different states had gotten together, and in Tennessee, a certain representative by the name of John Washington Butler was involved. He was a representative in the state legislature, and he submitted a bill that was quite similar to the bills that were presented in the other states, 20 other states. This was March of 1925, and the bill read in large part this way: "It shall be unlawful for any teacher in any of the universities, normals, and all other public schools of the state, which are supported in whole or in part by the public school funds of the state, to teach any theory that denies the story of divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man is descended from a lower order of animals." Did I tell you there's going to be a test? Oh yeah, there always has to be a test. Here's the test for you, if you wish to take it. Could you teach the origin of reptiles from amphibians? Yeah. Could you teach the origin of life on Earth? Yeah. Could you teach the origin of birds from reptiles? Yeah. You could teach any kind of evolution you want. What could you not teach according to this bill? You could not teach that human beings came from a lower order of animals in opposition to the teachings of Scripture. You see, by this time in history, in 1925, the churches, by and large, had already caved on, first of all, on old Earth. That happened back in the 1700s, willing to embrace that the Earth was hundreds of thousands, if not millions, if not billions of years old. That gradually became assimilated. That pretty much made death natural. It was there from the get-go, so Christians were willing to accept that death is pretty much a part of life, and they all agreed that they could somehow make Christianity comparable, or compatible, I should say. But the origin of man from a beast, that was still a tough pill to swallow. It was kind of the last holdout. And so this bill basically put its foot down on that, as did the bills of 20 other states. But the American Civil Liberties Union out of New York City chose to fight the bill as a test case in Tennessee. I don't know why they picked Tennessee, but they chose Tennessee, and they knew that if they could undo the bill there, it would apply to the other 20 states as well, or would eventually. But remember, everything you see, if it's what you see it, what you hear, it's opposite of the truth, which I'll demonstrate. Here they are in poor John Scope's classroom, and you can see him doing exactly the thing he was told not to do. What if what I told you were true, that if you just look at everything and turn it on its head, upside down, and assume the opposite's true, what do you know so far? Let's go down the line. Nobody came into Scopes' classroom that wasn't a student or for proper official purposes. Nobody invaded his classroom. Two, you saw him teaching biology? He wasn't the biology teacher. He wasn't even a science teacher. He taught math and coached the football team. You saw him thrown in jail, right? He never spent a day in jail in his whole life. He wasn't jailed for this. The only thing they got right in that whole clip was the number of the bill. That's accurate. Well, let's move on here. Let's talk about the real world here. This is the real John Scopes right here, not quite as handsome as... That's his father. Boy, was he a piece of work. I wish I had some time to talk about him. This is in July of 1925. Let me tell you, it was hot. That week of the trial was as hot or hotter than it is right here now. It was even hot for that area, Tennessee, in July. No air conditioning, right? A little different world than we have today. But that's the real John Scopes. I told you that he wasn't the biology teacher. He did graduate in pre-law from the University of Kentucky. In fact, he's buried in Kentucky near Louisville. He taught 1 year out of his entire life. And that was in the Ray County School District in Dayton, Tennessee. He taught math and coached the football team. He was well-liked. Guess why he was well-liked in his community? Because he really was a good math teacher? No, the football team did rather well under John Scopes. So he got along great with everybody. How on earth did he ever get involved with the Scopes trial, since he wasn't the biology teacher and really didn't know anything about evolution, didn't care about it? Well, he filled in for a sick biology teacher the last 2 weeks of the school year. So you might just say, here's a poor guy in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he had some friends that got him into trouble. First lesson you're going to learn from this is be careful who your friends are. They can get you in all kinds of trouble. This is from an article that was written at the time of the Scopes trial. Or a newspaper reporter speaking at the time of the Scopes trial. This reporter is being told by John Scopes, there's something I must tell you. It's worried me. I didn't violate the law. Now, wait a minute. When's the last time you've worried yourself sick over not violating a law? The problem is he got himself roped into the Scopes trial as a teacher who taught evolution when he had really hadn't, and it became a whole worldwide thing, and he was just in over his head very quickly. He said, those kids they put on the stand couldn't remember what I taught them 3 months ago. Now, there's a real teacher. They were coached by the lawyers. Wait a minute. The lawyers coached them to say they were taught evolution by John Scopes when they weren't? You know, there's a name for that. What's it called? Perjury. Yeah, simple perjury. Is this trial getting kind of interesting for you so far? Scopes went on to say, I've been scared all through the trial that the kids might remember I missed the lesson. I was afraid they'd get on the stand and say I hadn't taught it, and then the whole trial would go bluey. If that happened, they'd run me out of town on a rail. In other words, he was scared of being exposed as a liar in all of this and a fraud, and he'd be sort of run out of town on a rail. But he got roped into it nonetheless. Now, how did he get roped into it? Well, he had a young friend by the name of George Replaya. George Replaya, originally from New York City, or New York State, I should say, he operated the Cumberland Iron and Coal Mine in Dayton, Tennessee. And if you visit Dayton today, you can see a big notch out of the mountain where they had been digging out ore, or coal, and iron. And George Replaya really was the guy who was initially responsible for getting the Scopes trial going in Dayton, Tennessee. This is what he hoped to achieve. He had hoped to promote economic interest in Dayton. Particularly, he was interested in getting the ore from his company downriver, where it could be shipped, and he needed economic investment from outside to do this. So he hoped by hosting this famous trial, getting some publicity for the little town of Dayton, that he would draw investment. So that really is the underlying motive for why it happened in Dayton. The American Civil Liberties Union was the underlying motive for why this issue was being pursued in the first place. The people of Dayton had nothing to do with it. Replaya talked to his friend. He hadn't known him very long because John Scopes was only there for a year, and they were similar age, and he talked him into cooperating with the American Civil Liberties Union's test case, which he did. Now, where did Replaya find out about this whole business? He had been down in Chattanooga on business from Dayton, and there in the Chattanooga Times, he had read an advertisement from the American Civil Liberties Union. And it had a lot of things to say, talking about the kind of dreadful people who were opposed to evolution. But the ad basically said this: "We are looking for a Tennessee teacher who's willing to accept our services in testing this law in the courts." So they're out looking. How did they dial a wrong number? They got John Scopes. How on earth did they get John Scopes? Well, Replaya read the ad. He could care less whether Scopes had taught biology or not. It's the only teacher he knew. He thought he could bring some investment if he get the trial in Dayton. So he talked Scopes into participating. And when Scopes tried to beg off for various reasons, Replaya still kept bugging him, and he finally agreed, very reluctantly. And then Scopes sent this letter off to the ACLU in New York. See how many fibs you can pick out in this letter. "Professor," you got one already, "J.T. Scopes, teacher of science," you should have another, "in the Ray County High School, Dayton, Tennessee, will be arrested and charged with teaching evolution. He will be under the following conditions: consent of the superintendent of education, and that he would be defended by the ACLU at no cost, of course. Wire me collect if you wish to cooperate, and arrest will follow." In other words, we're not going to arrest this guy unless the ACLU said, "Yeah, we'll accept you. In the test case, we'll pay the cost." Well, the ACLU bit. They bit on this thing, and they accepted Scopes as the teacher. And a lawyer became involved by the name of Sue Hicks, and of course you all know Sue Hicks. I don't have to really... You don't know. I thought you did. Well, anyway, you should know him because, after all, he was a lawyer in the Dayton law firm of Hicks & Hicks. That was with his father. It doesn't ring any bells. Yeah, I can see that. Well, you should know him because, you see, he was the one that prepared the arrest warrant for John. Okay, so you don't know him. I see that. Also, he was the one that actually arrested Scopes and then released him on a $1,000 bond, which was paid for by the ACLU. So they still doesn't ring a bell. You can see that. Here's what's really great about Sue Hicks is that he was the one who came up with the brainstorm of inviting William Jennings Bryan. Oh, this is going to be huge now. You'll see why in a bit. This is going to really make this trial of interest to everybody. He invited William Jennings Bryan to help in the prosecution or to lead the prosecution of John Scopes, and I can see even that doesn't jog your memory, but I do think you know Sue Hicks. You see, this is the boy named Sue. Remember the old Johnny Cash song, Boy Named Sue? That was written not by Johnny Cash. It was written by some songwriter in the Cumberland Mountains, and it was well known at the time that Sue Hicks had a name that people laughed about. It sounded like a gal's name, and it was on a guy, and he must have taken a huge amount of heat on this, that a whole song was written about it. So, admit it, you've heard of Sue, right? Sue Hicks, most of you at least, if you're into this kind of thing, and I like Johnny Cash. Well, this is a famous picture here. This is taken in the Robinson's Drugstore. You know these little towns, and it's true even today, you've got some hangout where all the locals show up to talk about things. Now, this was the case at Robinson's Drugstore, which sadly they've torn down in Dayton. Some of the buildings are still left related to the trial, but this was torn down. And this picture was taken in Robertson's Drugstore. There's the old ice cream table, and they had the heart wire background seats and what have you. Sitting at the table there is John Scopes looking at a biology textbook, Hunter Civic Biology. You see, the reason that textbook became important is during the 2 weeks that John Scopes was filling in for the teacher who was sick, the biology teacher, they were preparing for their final exams. And they used Hunter's Civic Biology in biology. It was a well-used, well-known book of the time. We have a copy of it there at Answers in Genesis. And Rapleia went through that book with him and said, look, okay, so you didn't teach evolution of man from a lower form of animal, but you did help the students get ready for their final exams, or at least kept them from killing one another in the room. And if the book teaches this, basically you did. So that was the whole logic. So the book did indeed teach that. By the way, this is Rapleia back here, and these are the Hicks family here that were lawyers in the case. This is what the book said, and this is what passed for science back then, and sadly it's not too much different now. If we follow the history of man upon the face of the earth, we find that at first he must have done little better than one of the lower animals. At the present time, oh wait, you get this one. At the present time, there exist upon the earth 5 races or varieties of man. The highest type of all, the Caucasians, represented by the civilized white inhabitants of Europe and America. Now, this was being vigorously defended by the liberal churches of the day. They were all for evolution. They thought it was wonderful. They fought tooth and nail against anyone who would deny this. Look at the incredible racism that's just inherently a part. I'm not saying all evolutionists are racist, but evolutionism itself is intrinsically racist. Look at this. This is eugenics, basically, that you find in civic biology. It said that if such people were lower animals, we would probably kill them off to prevent them from spreading. We do have the remedy of separating the sexes in asylums or other places and in various ways preventing intermarriage and the possibility of perpetuating such a low and degenerate race. So this was quite acceptable to the American Civil Liberties Union. This was quite acceptable to liberal churches. I wish I could say it was not acceptable to so-called conservative churches of the time, but I'm afraid they had their hand in racism too. Well, here we are in New York City. I don't think John Scopes had ever been there before. Once he agreed to go along with the trial, they brought him into the big city. Here he is at the table, and next to him are some pretty famous people that participated in the trial. Let me back up a bit here. I thought he had an arrow. This gentleman right here is Clarence Darrow. He was the lead prosecution, very famous, as you'll see. And next to him is Dudley Field Malone, who played a role in the trial. We'll encounter him, John Randolph Neal. And you just take a look at these American Civil or these ACLU people, you could tell you wouldn't want to disagree with them about anything. Well, William Jennings Bryan agreed to participate. So it's going to be Clarence Darrow, very famous criminal lawyer, outspoken agnostic, very anti-Christian in his approach, going up against William Jennings Bryan, your sort of perfect Sunday school teacher. He had a Sunday school class in Florida with over 1,000 students. They had to meet outside. He was a well-known politician in the Democratic Party at the time. He was called the Great Commoner. He's an immensely popular man, and sort of would certainly represent Christianity. So are we going to have fireworks or not? Big court crowd, we're going to have this super Christian, the super atheist, and going to argue creation and evolution. It was hot. You can see he had a pith helmet. Well, the whole movie, in fact, if you read the instructions for the play, you know, given to the actors, you know, if you're William Jennings Bryan, you're supposed to, like, belch a lot and just generally behave like a buffoon. And if you're the lawyer for the prosecution, Clarence Darrow, then you're supposed to be very kind, but very firm and very intellectual. Well, this just gives you one little sample of how William Jennings Bryan is portrayed. Here he is right here. He's the Christian, the one who will be prosecuting John Scopes for teaching evolution. And take a look at how they portray him.
Thank you.
He's the only one eating, notice. He's obviously being portrayed as a bit of a glutton here. It turns out he had diabetes, and this was in a time when it was even more dangerous than it is today. And primarily it was controlled by diet. And so he had to eat at certain times, not eat at certain times, to keep his blood sugar level, but that's all parlayed into just simple gluttony by the Hollywood heretics. What about the real Jennings Bryan? You hear him speaking there. He sounds arrogant. You wouldn't want to listen to him too long. Sprague de Camp again had this to say about William Jennings Bryan, and he was no fan of him. He says, as a speaker, Bryan radiated good-humored sincerity. Few who heard him could help liking him. In personality, he was forceful, energetic, and opinionated, but genial, kindly, generous, likable, and charming. He showed a praiseworthy tolerance towards those who disagreed with him. Bryan was the greatest American orator of his time, and perhaps any time. Well, that's not the guy in the movie or the play, I'll tell you that. Well, let's take a look here at just exactly who was William Jennings Bryan. He lived from 1860 to 1925. This is a picture of him when he was a young man. He was a great American orator, popular Chautauqua speaker. This is back not only before television, but this is even before radio, or at least when radio was in its infancy. And people would have speakers, I guess, or like me, come through to a city, and you'd go down to the band shell in the park. It was usually outside, and there was no PA system like I have here where you can all hear me easily. You'd stand in the band shell, or maybe be 1,000 people or more out there, and you would give them a lecture on some subject, and they'd all have to be able to hear your voice. And William Jennings Bryan had a voice that people don't know exactly what it was about it, but you could hear it anywhere. And it wasn't really booming. It wasn't deep. It was actually a little high-pitched, but he was easy to hear. And he was a great orator. And you read some of the orations and lectures that they gave today, you'd never get away with it. Nobody would know what on earth you're talking about. You'd have to have a complete command of Scripture, knowing all of the characters of the Bible and the basic events and stories there. You'd have to know Greek mythology. I can't believe you could go into the countryside, give lectures like this, and people seem to be on board. He was an outspoken Christian. He was a leader of the Democratic Party for, depending on how you look at it, anywhere from 25 to 30 years. He ran 3 times for President of the United States and never was elected. And this puzzled me as I first began to look into this trial. This guy's called the Great Commoner. He's a Christian when it was popular to be a Christian. And he resonated with a lot of people. And in many ways, he was very conservative socially. But he was extremely liberal for his day in other issues other than social issues, and I think that as much as anything kept him from being elected. He served as Secretary of State under President Woodrow Wilson. It was kind of a gift to him for supporting the party for all those years. This is his voice. So that's part of the man. In his later life, we can say that these are the things he supported, and for his time, these were really progressive issues. He supported the popular election of senators. He supported the development of the federal income tax. Okay, so let's let bygones be bygones, shall we? He was for the unlimited coinage of silver. You're probably not aware of this, but at one time we were on the gold standard. And then they went from gold to silver because silver was more abundant and increased the money supply. And then they dropped the silver. Even in my lifetime, all the silver coins quickly vanished once they were replaced by base metals. And today, our monetary system really isn't based on anything other than the trust that a piece of paper is worth some quantity of value. It's not backed up by gold or silver or anything else. But he was one of the first to really push for bimetallism, the use of silver as well as gold, and finally that was taken away. He supported the Department of Labor, Department of Health, Education and Welfare, Workmen's Compensation, Minimum Wage, Women's Suffrage, Minority Rights, Pure Food and Drug Act, and very much a pacifist, actually. He tried to prevent the outbreak of World War I and was sort of opposed to war in principle. That's a bit about the man. He has some biographies written about him that go to like 8 volumes long. I think I will not get such a long biography when I die. So he's quite a man. How did the newspapers portray William Jennings Bryan in his day? Do I have to tell you? The newspapers were no different back then than they are now. Same sort of bias. For example, here's Bryan shown as a crusader on a horse crusading in the name of religion. That was in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Over here in the Chicago Tribune, they show Bryan as Don Quixote, foolishly jousting with windmills, which the windmill is evolution, and he's vainly charging the windmill. This is my favorite. It's from the Columbus Dispatch. It's titled Rubbish. It shows William Jennings Bryan standing on the edge of a deep precipice, going down into the dark ages down here. And he's dumping this garbage out, which he clearly doesn't want. And on each of these items that's falling, you see such names as Bryan is opposed to all of agriculture. He's opposed to the law of gravity, mathematics, mechanics, animal husbandry, medicine, surgery, x-rays, steam, and navigation. Wow, pretty thorough, nasty guy, huh? He wasn't opposed to any of this. But it was assumed then, as it is today, that if you are critical of evolution, you're opposed to all of science. I hear this all the time. I've been told I'm a flat earther so many times, I've actually tried to join the organization. I mean, if I'm going to be accused, I at least want to have some benefits, you know. I thought I had it. I looked on the internet all over. I finally got a lot of hits for the Flat Earth Society, and then I found out it was a rock band. So you never know about these things. How about Clarence Darrow? He was the fellow who came in as a lawyer for the defense of John Scopes, who, as you know, never taught evolution. But this is a and both lawyers knew it. Both lawyers knew it was just a test case. It was unimportant whether Scopes taught evolution or not. They just wanted to argue about the creation-evolution issue and whether it should be taught in the schools. Clarence Darrow is America's most famous criminal lawyer. I don't think there's been his equal when it comes to a criminal lawyer since. He was an agnostic. He was an atheist by anyone's definition, but he liked the word agnostic. It sort of sounded like he was open-minded, and in the event any evidence were to come up someday for the existence of God, he'd be happy to sign on, but he's just never seen such evidence. And he was really outspoken critic of what was called fundamentalism. He strongly opposed the death penalty. That kind of goes along with this sort of liberal view that there is no such thing as right and wrong. There's behavior which needs to be corrected according to a certain political correctness. And so he didn't think anyone was deserving of the death penalty, and one of his main areas of expertise was to keep people from getting the death penalty who were obviously guilty in many cases, and he was quite successful at that. He defended unpopular people and radical causes. That was kind of his specialty. He never did a freebie in his whole life until it came to the Scopes trial, and he did agree to do that at no cost. Just before the Scopes trial, he had defended Leopold and Loeb, another famous trial. These were two young men who were clearly brilliant. They were in their middle teens and already in university, I think University of Michigan, came from very affluent families. They had learned about Nietzsche in the Übermensch, you know, the superior man. Sadly, here's two young Jewish boys who are all caught up in Nietzsche, which was the whole basis of Nazism and their dealing with the Jews. But anyway, they considered themselves to be Übermensch, super people. And because of their affluence and their well-established intellectual ability, they thought that they were free to do anything they wanted. And whatever they did would be perfect, and so they decided to commit the perfect murder. They killed, I think it was a cousin, Bobby Franks. Killed him and stuffed his body in a culvert. Then they called his father, whom they knew, and said, he's safe and sound here. Leave a certain amount of money and you'll have him back. He left the money. Obviously, he didn't get his son back. The perfect crime turned out to be something less than a perfect crime. They were apprehended within a week. It seems that one of them had left his glasses behind, and these glasses were sufficiently unusual and sophisticated that very few people would have had them, and they quickly found out it was these two. One of them was killed in jail. The other one finally, after serving time, was set free. but Darrow did keep them from getting the death penalty by arguing that they were taught these things in college, and you can't blame them for acting on things which they had been taught. Kind of a strange defense, but it worked. How did the media portray Darrow? Much better. Much better. Here is Clarence Darrow scolding William Jennings Bryan, who's portrayed as a crying little boy, and he's being told by Darrow, there ain't no Santa Claus. Big, huge shock for William Jennings Bryan, obviously. Sometimes the media sort of played this game, sort of played up the whole monkey business. Here it shows Darrow talking to a monkey, and the monkey is saying, Papa. Well, let's get back to the movie. Oh, you're going to find out the Christians. I remember the first time I saw this movie. When I get done watching this movie, I had this strange, strong urge to go out, find the first Christian I could find, and strangle him. I mean, it's just, you have to despise, and this is why this is shown in social studies classes across America. I was on a plane once, and sitting next to me was a lady grading papers, and I'm looking over, you know, and I could just tell it was a Scopes trial. I said, you grading papers on the Scopes trial? And yeah. And all the same myths that you're learning about here, the students learned about is truth. They had seen this movie. That was their knowledge of the Scopes trial, and that's what they were writing on. You'll see in a bit what they mostly chose to write about. Well, here are the good folks of Tennessee, okay? John Scopes is in jail. He's looking out the window, and these good Christian folks are outside, and they're singing the battle hymn of the Republic. You got the picture here? This is the South we're talking about. And the battle hymn of the Republic was the battle song, the battle anthem of the Union Army of the North. I mean, can Hollywood get anything right? I mean, you think he'd get this right? So, anyway, here it goes. You're going to see what Christians are like. What do you think of Christians so far? This guy was never in jail. This is a total myth. The people of Dayton, Tennessee engaged in no outburst against him. They liked him. He didn't teach evolution. He had a successful football team. He taught math. He didn't have a problem with anybody. And that's the way it's portrayed. And you hear this in a college social studies course or high school social studies course, and this is taught to you as the history of the Scopes trial. What do you think of Christians so far? Well, it gets worse. It gets a lot worse. Here it is. This is what every student chose to write on whose paper I saw being graded. They wrote on the Reverend Jeremiah Brown, who's totally non-existent. There's nobody like him in the whole of the Scopes trial. Reverend Jeremiah Brown represents conservative Christianity, or Christianity in general. Wouldn't you know it? His daughter's dating John Scopes. Now, John Scopes wasn't going with any girl at that time. Back then, I mean, this is 1925. You're only in town for a year. You don't meet any girls during that time. He wasn't dating anybody that we know of. So there's no Rachel Brown, who's the daughter of the Reverend Jeremiah Brown, who's presumably widowed or possibly killed his wife after seeing this video. This is William Jennings Bryan with his wife listening to Jeremiah Brown give this sermon out there. If you want to know what the world, what your professors in college will think of you and your religion, or how Hollywood perceives Christianity, this sums it up about as well as anything. Here is the Reverend Jeremiah Brown. That's Hollywood view of Christianity. You know, there's two kinds of religion in the world. There's only two. There's God's word and there's man's word. And man's religion is always the same. Works righteousness. Do good, you get rewarded. Do bad, you get your lights punched out. God's religion is you can't do any good. You're hopeless. You're lost. But through undeserved grace, He sends the Son of the world to die for your sins, to save you from sin, death, and power of Satan. Hollywood knows nothing about this. They're talking about killing his own daughter because she dares to have grace on a sinner. As though God, through Christ, has never had grace in a sinner. I mean, this is a chasm that just can't even be crossed. It's infinitely wide. But every student chose to write about the Reverend Jeremiah Brown and how he asked that God would kill his own daughter for having grace on a sinner. Well, what did Clarence Darrow say about the citizens of Dayton, Tennessee? That might help to set the record straight. By the way, this is right out of the transcript of the trial. All the data I'm presenting you is based on reading the transcript of the trial, not a book about the trial. I read several of those. But it's the transcript of the trial. And in the transcript, Clarence Darrow said this about the folks of Dayton, Tennessee. I don't know as I was ever in a community in my life where my religious ideas differed as widely from the great mass as I have found them since I've been in Tennessee. Yet I came here a perfect stranger, and I can say what I've said before, that I have not found upon anybody's part, any citizen here in this town or outside, the slightest discourtesy. I have been treated better, kindlier, and more hospitably than I fancied would have been the case in the North. That's the reality. A little different than the movie. Yeah, a lot different than the movie or the play. Well, the Wake County Courthouse still stands. I've been there a couple of times. You can visit it in Dayton. There's some historical exhibits down in the basement. I think it's worth a trip. This is the way the courtroom looks today, pretty much the way it did back then. Same old metal ceiling up there. The lights are different, but the seating is the same. The windows are the same. This, in fact, is the way it looked back in 1925. The principal difference was the pot-bellied stove, and believe me, they didn't need it in July that year. It was upper 90s. And no air conditioning. Now, this is the way the courtroom looked when it was full the day of the trial. And was this a popular trial or what? There were so many newsmen that they couldn't even fit in the town. And they certainly didn't fit in the courtroom. It was covered by 2,000 newsmen who came from all over the world. People moved out of their homes so that newsmen could move in. And you still couldn't accommodate all the people. The vast majority of people representing newspapers across the world were never in the trial at all. They were just hanging around and writing about it, their preconceived notions of religion. And after seeing this video here, you can see their preconceived notions for many of them would be very similar to that. This is a famous picture of Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan taken at the time of the trial. You can see it's hot. Here's the fan. Darrow smoking away on his cigarette there. A lot of interesting pictures from the trial. The only legal question in this whole trial, technically, was did John Scopes violate the Butler Act by teaching that man descended from a lower order of animals? Technically, that was the only issue. It wasn't whether evolution was right or wrong or creation was right or wrong. Did he violate the law? Both sides, the defense and the prosecution, knew that John Scopes hadn't taught it, that they really got the wrong guy, but they were so keen in pursuing his test case, they were willing to go through and play the role. Because it was really the issue of what authority do parents have over what is taught in the public school, and should evolution be taught in our public schools? That was the real issue. Scopes had little to do with it. Bryan himself gave the objectives of the trial in his memoirs that were written after his death. He said his first objective was to establish the right of taxpayers to control what is taught in their schools. That sound familiar? Resonate with anyone? He said that his second objective was to draw a line between teaching evolution as a fact and teaching it as a theory. I would correct that only by saying teach it as a paradigm because it's not a theory. It doesn't measure up to a theory. There's no way to disprove it. And thirdly, his third objective was to see teachers proven guilty of this offense, teaching evolution to man, that they should be given an opportunity to resign. He was totally against anything like jail time or a fine. What was Scopes' Garrow's objective. In his own autobiography, The Story of My Life, he gave his objective. He said he only had one. My only object was to focus the attention of the country on the program of Mr. Bryan and the other fundamentalists in America. Now, bear in mind, Darrow had twice supported Bryan when he ran for president of the United States, because Bryan was, for his day, a liberal. Except in theology, he was a liberal. But by the third time, he'd pretty well had it with Darrow. Well, these are the gentlemen of the jury. It just happened to be that in this trial, all of the jurors were males. In the movie, they portray them all as being utterly uneducated, incapable of reading. This was true of maybe one or two of them, but otherwise they were a good cross-section of the people of Dayton, Tennessee. This is the judge over here in the end, Judge Ralston. This is a picture of Bryan addressing the court. Look at the old microphone sitting on a 2x4. This is the beginning of radio. This was the first trial broadcast across the transatlantic cable, which had just been put down, and people all over the world were hearing this trial. Bryan was portrayed as a know-nothing fundamentalist. I'll just give you a little bit of a clip on this. This is supposed to show Bryan was a complete idiot, knew nothing about evolution. That's the way Christians are portrayed, who dare to be critical of evolution. Here, Bryan is revealing that he knows absolutely nothing about Darwinism, has never read anything about it, doesn't ever want to read anything about it. What do you know? If everything's the opposite of the truth, not only had he read it, not only read it 25 years before the trial, but he submitted the book as evidence in the trial as to what Darwin actually said. So Bryan, not Darrow, submitted Darwin's book, Descent of Man. It wasn't really Origin of Species. It was Descent of Man, where Darwin says man came from a lower order of animals. Bryan had read Darwin's Origin of Species in 1905, 20 years before the trial. I've met very few people who can look me in the face and not smile and say that they've read Darwin's Origin of Species cover to cover. It is the most convoluted, confusing book that you could ever possibly read. I urge you to take a crack at it and see if you could be one of the first people I've met who have covered to cover it. I've tried, Lord, how I've tried, and I've never succeeded in getting through it in its entirety. Bryan actually carried on a long correspondence with evolutionists of his day, including Henry Fairfield Osborne. So he'd be like a creationist today. He was pretty knowledgeable about the creation-evolution controversy and discussed it with a lot of scientists. Knew what he was talking about. Darrow, on the other hand, had almost no clue. I gave you evidence of that. Evolutionists claim that life evolved from a primitive cell. You're aware of that, that all life comes from some primordial cell. But in the Scopes trial, what they did was to declare that the cell that all life comes from is the egg. So what they did was to equate embryology with evolution. So if you believe in embryology, that humans come from a cell, you know, and develop, that's evolution. You're thinking, oh, come on, it can't be that bad. Oh, yeah, it was that bad. Let me prove it. Here are the people of the defense, starting with Clarence Darrow. This is Judge Ralston. What did Clarence Darrow say about the whole thing? Judge Ralston asked Darrow if all life came from a single cell, because they're saying in evolution all life comes from a single cell. Look at this. This is satanically clever. Well, I'm not quite so clear, but I think it did. All human life comes from one cell. You came from one, and I came from one. Isn't that clever? Didn't you all come from a cell? Yeah, fertilized egg. We talked about it. The zygote. They were finessing this in while talking about all life evolving from some common cell ancestor. You can imagine how confused the jury got on this. Here's Arthur Garfield Hayes. What did he say about this? He's another lawyer for the defense. He said, I know that in the womb of the mother, the very first thing is a cell, and that cell grows and it subdivides and grows into a human being, and a human being is born. Does that statement, as the boy stated on the stand, that he was taught that man comes from a cell, i.e. an egg, Does that is that a theory? Is that a theory that man descended from a lower order of animals? I don't know, and I dare say Your Honor has some doubt about it. Are we entitled to find out whether it is or not in presenting this case to the jury? Finessing embryology as evolution, getting the jury to say, yes, embryology is real, ergo, we can teach the evolution of man from beasts in the classroom. You think, well, that's just two of the lawyers. Well, let's try another one. Dudley Field Malone. He said, the embryo becomes a human being when it's born. Notice it's not a human being until it's born. This is a Roman Catholic, by the way, here. Evolution never stops from the beginning of the one cell until the human being returns in death to lifeless dust. We wish to set before you evidence of this character in order to stress the importance of the theory of evolution. Do you see a bamboozlement going on here? This is pure bamboozlement. I don't know if that's a word, but I couldn't think of anything else to fit in there. They brought in a bunch of expert witnesses. They weren't allowed to testify because this wasn't the issue of the trial, whether evolution was right or wrong. Finally, they got permission to have the evolutionists testify, but Brian insisted that they should be cross-examined. Darrow was so opposed to having his experts cross-examined that he never called them into witness after the first one. But we did get one. We got this gentleman right here from Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Maynard Metcalf. He did testify, and so we can find out what the others might have said by just looking at his testimony. This is what he said. I have always been particularly interested in the evolution of the individual organism from the egg, and also the evolution of the organism as a whole from the beginning of life. That's been a peculiar interest of mine always. In other words, this was a planned thing. Everybody was going to go for the embryology and bring in the idea of man coming from an egg in the womb, and that was going to get everybody confused. Well, the judge did get confused, and so the judge asked Maynard Metcalf, who kept using the phrase fact of evolution, he asked him to define the fact. And in the trial transcript, this is one sentence. I don't think I can get through it without a breath, but here's how it goes. This is what a Johns Hopkins professor, this is how he defined evolution, to clarify the fact of evolution. Here it is. Evolution, I think, means the change. In the final analysis, I think it means the change of an organism from one character into a different character, and by character I mean its structure, its behavior, or its function, or its method of development from the egg or anything else. Oh, I did, that's broad. The change of an organism from one set characteristic, which characterizes it, into a different condition, characterized by a different set of characteristics, either structural or functional, could properly be called, I think, evolution. To be the evolution of that organism, but the term in general means the whole series of such changes which have taken place during hundreds of millions of years, which have produced from lowly beginnings, the nature of which is not by any means fully understood to organism of a much more complex character, whose structure and function we are still studying because we haven't begun to need to know about, or begun to learn what we need to know about. You now have the fact of evolution from Johns Hopkins. You can save the money going there to school. Well, they put Brian on the witness stand. I'm going to run a little over here, but this is important. I just have to do it. They put Brian on the witness stand, and he let his pride get ahead of him. And this is the first time in all of American jurisprudence that the lawyer has taken the witness stand as an expert on the issue being contested in the trial. And so Brian agreed to be cross-examined by Darrow on Christianity and creationism, with the understanding that the next day Darrow would take the witness stand and he would be grilled on agnosticism and evolution. Well, Darrow had no intent of ever giving him that crack, and he didn't get it. But Brian took his turn, and he was urged not to do it. These are some of the questions he was asked. Brian, did Jonah really swallow the whale? You have to kind of think on that one. Do you believe Joshua made the sun stand still? Do you believe the story of the flood to be literal? Do you believe everything except perhaps fish were wiped out in the flood? How long ago did Noah's flood occur? How old is the earth? Darrow was a very clever man. Darrow knew how to nail him. And he nailed him. You see, Brian for a while stuck tough. Darrell just ridiculed the Bible. And Brian would come back and just read the text of the Bible to him and say, well, that's what the Bible says. Do you believe this? Well, right here in the Bible, that's what the Bible says. Do you believe this? Right here in the Bible, that's what the Bible says. He did this again and again, and it put Darrell in the place of basically saying, you and your fool Bible. And this was not going over. Even the American Civil Liberties Union could see this was a bad way to go. They were losing the support of the American public. The Bible was just being ridiculed again and again. Darrell was called a fool for daring to believe it. If he'd have done this to the end, he'd have been fine. But when it came to the age of the earth, thanks to the fact that Christianity had already stumbled on this issue, and sad to say, I could name some Christians who've written some very famous books, who've written biblical commentaries, who did their part to undermine the 6 days of creation and the young earth. And so Brian had stumbled on that, and Darrell knew how to nail him, and this is how it all went down. Darrell, this is right from the transcript of the trial. You have the page numbers, you'd like to look it up. Darrell said, do you think the earth was made in 6 days? Brian says, not in 6 days, or 24 hours. Darrell says, doesn't it say so in the Bible? Brian says, no, sir. Darrell says, oh, this is so sad, I hate to read this. This is an atheist talking to a Christian now, okay? An atheist talking to a Christian. Does the statement, the morning and evening, where the first day and the morning and evening were the second day, mean anything to you? Brian came back, I don't see that there's any necessity for constructing the words the evening and morning as meaning necessarily a 24-hour day. Oh, he's ready for the slaughter now. Wait till it comes. Darrell, so creation might have been going on for a very long time, huh? Brian, it might have continued for millions of years. That was the end of the trial. Darrell came in the next day. Supposed to be his turn, right, to get grilled on agnosticism. He goes up to the judge and asks the judge to instruct the jury to find his own client, John Scopes, guilty as charged. Throughout the whole trial to the end, there were no closing arguments. Nothing at all. It all just came to a final halt. It was appealed and overthrown on an appeal due to a technicality, the whole Scopes thing. So he was supposed to be fined $200. Everybody wanted to pay that fine, including Brian. Here he is on the last day of the trial. He's guilty, big deal. It's all going to be paid for. He never tried it anyway. Here's Brian. He died shortly after the trial. He had been hit by a car. He didn't get killed from that. He went around looking for a place to build Brian College. And he died Sunday, July 26, 1925, the day this picture was taken. And is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. If you defend God's word, what kind of treatment you gonna get? Boy, I've done a lot of it, and I can tell you some stories. I've had my life threatened right up on the stage at a university, Sussex University in England. Here's what H.R. Mencken, who was sort of the typical liberal newspaper commentator at the time, this was his obituary. This is the obituary for William Jennings Bryan. Bryan was deluded by a childish theology full of almost a pathological hatred of all learning, all human dignity, all beauty, all fine and noble things. Imagine a gentleman and you've imagined everything he was not. Clarence Darrell said in the newspaper, well, we've killed the SOB. That's, if they treated Christ that way, what's going to happen to us? Well, this is available out there, this whole business, inherently when the Scopes trial, if you're interested in it. Sorry I went a little bit over, but I did want to get it all in, and thank you very kindly. We're going to be talking about that issue that Brian stumbled on. We'll be talking about that next. What a difference a day makes. Thank you.